Hey, this is Zach.
And I'm Clint, and we wanted to thank ExoTerra for sponsoring this episode of Colubrid and Colubroid Radio.
ExoTerra is the industry leader in glass terrarium enclosures, and we are a big fan of getting to see the species we work with both at home and at the university.
We utilize ExoTerra caging here at Metazotics, and in addition to top quality terrariums, ExoTerra offers an array of heating options, lighting, supplements, decor, and truthfully, anything needed or wanted when keeping reptiles.
Thank you, ExoTerra, for supporting Colubrid and Colubroid Radio. Hello, all. Welcome to another episode of Colubrid and Colubroid Radio. Zach here, as always, with Clint. How you doing, man?
Doing great, buddy. Doing great. How are you doing?
I'm hanging in there. It's been an interesting couple days. More on that at a later point in time. sorry for the delay, y'all. Clint and I had a weather event that was hitting us last week when we had this episode scheduled. It was really kind of goofy. He's in Evansville, Indiana. I'm in Wheeling, West Virginia. And there was a point where the end of the storm was in Evansville and the front end of the storm was in Wheeling. And we had to call it because we knew that power was going to go out and we didn't want to have to re-record with our guest.
And it did.
Yeah, it did. Yeah. Clint will inform you all about the craziness that was the power at Metazotics with this whole thing. So our hypothesis was correct, but our guest tonight is an awesome guest. We're really looking forward to this episode. It's going to be an interesting one. We have Ashley, I hope I don't butcher this name, Dazan.
You got it.
There you go. So, Ashley, many of you that are listeners, especially those of you who like the oddball species, know Ashley well. Ashley is both an exporter and an importer. And she is probably the reason why we have certain genera in North American herpetoculture. We felt the need to address importation, exportation, and there's not a better person to do it than Ashley. So we're going to be talking about that. And then the other thing we're going to be talking about at the end of the episode is a colubroid, and it's an extremely badass colubroid, a pseudoxenodon, the bamboo snakes, sometimes called false cobras, but bamboo snakes probably better. These guys are related to dipsadids. The argument's out whether it's closely or you know, distantly, but we'll get into that when we get there. So a whole bunch of nerdy colubrid wonderfulness will be in this particular episode. But before we jump into that, we have our housekeeping and our updates. And so I'm going to turn it over to Clint to just give an update of what's been going on at Metazotics and to give the market update.
All right, buddy. It's been, there's been a lot that's going on really in the few weeks that we've not recorded here. So there's been tons of breeding happening. I mean, we've got gravid girls all over the place for sure. Quick side note, this actually just happened yesterday. I've been on the hunt for an adult male Raines rat snake for a few years now. And I got to give Drew, my nursery guy, because we keep our female back there in the nursery. So he's in love with that thing. And out of the blue, he sends me a screenshot of an available male that just popped up. And it may have been on there for an hour. I don't know, but I grabbed it right away. And so we now have that coming. So stoked about that. But anyways, lots of gravid females happening. We just had, did the Evansville show. Side note about the Evansville show that we just did, had a gentleman who was visiting family in Owensboro, Kentucky, and he was up from Louisiana, came to the show and walked up and said, "I just want to let you guys know I love the podcast." And I just thought it was so neat. Somebody visiting from Louisiana, you know, walks up and says that. And I just thought that was awesome.
Fantastic.
That was really neat. I've got one more show to do weekend after this one in Lexington, Kentucky. And then I think I've got a full month off of shows.
Holy hell, man.
Yeah. So, right. So, you know, still a lot of catch up. We had the eclipse that just came through here, and Evansville was in the path of totality. So, today was hectic because normally Mondays were closed, but I'm here and getting a lot of the behind the scenes stuff done. And we were all out. I mean, I've got that property 30 minutes away, 45 minutes away that we had a big gathering of people. We camped out, had a blast. I mean, and it was so cool to see that, you know, in totality. That's first time I've ever seen one, you know, like that. So that was a blast. But that also means all schools were shut down in Evansville. All governmental agencies are shut down. So, you know, a lot going on there. But the storms, man.
The storms.
So listeners, check this out. And, you know, I'm not an electrician, so I know there's somebody who's going to be able to explain this to us. This was the first time I've ever had half power. And what I mean is now the shop is on 2 meters. We're a rather large building. And I would understand if we had a if we had one half of the building that had power and the other half didn't, but that wasn't the case. Both sides of the building had half power whenever that storm came through. So like, I mean, on our showroom floor, if we've got, let's say, a dozen lights, we had five that worked. And then it came back on in stages. So then we had eight that worked and now the office works, but those outlets don't. And it just boom, 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 till finally it all came back, but it was weird. And then at my house, we never lost power through the storm, but as soon as the storm was over, we heard a transformer blow, and then I was without power for a day, you know, all that night. So it was just frustrating. So yes, postponing was definitely the right call, you know, for us.
Yeah.
But a lot of good things going on. It seems like there was more that I had thought of that I, you know, wanted to share with everybody from a, you know, Metazotics and just what's going on here standpoint, but yeah, it's been
well. I know,
wild.
Both of us are. There's just breeding happening everywhere.
Oh gosh, yeah, yeah,
yeah. It's nuts. How much the storms and the low pressure systems moving through, which is oftentimes thought to be a trigger, and I, you know, there's some science to back that. But I have the king snakes at my house, and I decided that I was going to pair everybody, and I paired them right before that low pressure system moved through, and this is my third year with the Kings. So, and they're, you know, I understand if you're listening, these are just king snakes. There's nothing fancy. I just do this because they're easy and they're fun. But it took me about 10 minutes to pair about 12 pairs together. And then I left the garage where the animals are. And then I came back in and it sounded like there were coked up rats in the tubs. There was so much thrashing and like banging around. And I was like, what the hell? And they're king snakes. So I assumed like, oh crap, they're eating each other. And then I pulled open and nope, the males were just getting to it immediately. Like there was no hesitation. It was, and I had a first time in my life, I put 12 pairs together and I had 12 locks within an hour. So
it's funny, you know, I'm walking through it was the North American room and same thing. I mean, there's tons of just, you know, locks everywhere. And cause you know, with so many snakes in that one room, I've got this big chart of who's getting paired to who, you know, next and all that. And, you know, by the time I'm halfway through, there's like at least 20 pairs already paired up and, you know, and so then I'm like, I'm just curious. So I go back to the front, start pulling drawers and everything and just lock, 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 lock. And I'm walking through and it's funny the kinds of things that go through your mind, right?
Yes.
And I'm just playing that song in my head as I'm walking through the room. I smell sex and candy. Yeah. It's like just super happy that all that's going on, you know? Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's a blast, man.
Nice.
It's a blast. So,
yep.
I'll jump over to the market update real quick and then turn it over. So as always, the market update is brought to you by the Show Me Reptile Shows. We thank them for being a sponsor. Let's see, a few shows that Show Me has coming up. We've got on April 20th, there's a show in Atlanta, a show in Cape Girardeau, a show in Tampa. On the 21st of April, got a show in Tulsa. On the 27th of April, Murfreesboro, And on the 28th, North Kingstown. And there'll be tons going on in May as well. Some of the market feel, I guess, you know what? No, let's go with data and then I'll go to feelings. Yeah. How's that? That's probably a smarter way to do it. It has been 3 weeks instead of two, you know, with our normal comparison for Morph Market. But let's give some numbers because they are interesting. So as a total, again, this is just snakes. On March 13th, there were 53,800 snakes listed on Morph Market. As of today, 50,232. So a 6.6% drop across the board. And that when we were averaging 3% previously. So that's pretty substantial in that 3 week change. And there's another piece here that I thought was pretty interesting as well. So we saw ball pythons move from 40,500 to 38,152, basically had a drop of 2,358, which was more than double any of the other previous periods that we've been monitoring. And I think a big part of that is the utilization of the auctions that they're doing. And the thing that I want to say that I find interesting is, you know, that's the market segment that we're continuously hearing is drying up, is, you know, really struggling right now. And we've seen it and we've discussed it too. And I think what that kind of tells you right there is still market there. There's still want there. The auctions are bringing it into a price that people are willing to pay right now.
Yeah.
So that was real interesting. I mean, that's a 5.8% change just in ball pythons. But then we'll pop down boas. There was a 351 animal change, so a 6.8% drop. Colubrids, a 645 animal change, so 11%. And that was the leader. So 11% fewer colubrids listed than there just was almost 3 weeks ago. Again, we were looking at about a four, and that's actually continued to climb. So the first 2 weeks that we were tracking this, there was a 1% change, then a 3.3, then a 4.1, then an 11. So, I mean, it continues to show that these are actually, we're selling more and more of them at a faster pace, you know, colubrids as a whole. But to give some bigger numbers on that, colubrids, because, you know, that's what we always talk about here. There are currently 5,236 colubrids listed. Corn snakes make up 24.2% of that. Hognose make up 31.3%, which means all other colubrids are 33.5%, which that's 1,971 colubrids that are not a corn snake or a hognose. So still finding that very, very interesting. I had, as I said, last weekend, I did the Evansville, Indiana show. And I did talk to Mickey, the owner of Show Me, a little earlier. And we both kind of said the same thing, that this show, meaning he doesn't do the Evansville show, but the shows he was running this past weekend, attendance was a little softer this weekend than the same weekend last year. And that's the first time we've really seen that so far this year. Now, sales were generally good for the vendors that were, you know, doing what they needed to do. I can't complain at all, but even here in Evansville, attendance certainly was a little lower than what it had been previously. But I also looked at it as it makes sense. And that's because, one, we are experiencing, we're now towards the end of tax season for most. Okay. And combining that with probably a lot of the country, but I know definitely a lot here in the Midwest. We, in the last 2 weeks, just had spring breaks, which means you had a lot of money get spent on vacations, that kind of thing. So it would soften, you know, this particular show. On top of that, we had the eclipse. And that ran through, you know, a section that's all around me, including St. Louis. And so that was, it certainly affected some things too. So all that makes sense. Nothing I'm going to be worried about, but it's kind of following pattern, I guess.
It's all,
Yeah. Very interesting.
Yeah, it is. And it's, I mean, it's weird to use the word fun, but we're nerds and this is fun for me is seeing these patterns. And, you know, it's anytime something different happens, whether it's good, great, bad, it's just trying to dissect why it happened. You know, what is causing it? Is it micro, meaning like if it was just Evansville that I experienced this shorter, you know, or this, you know, a little bit less traffic, or is it macro? Is it something that, you know, we're seeing it shows, you know, all the shows that were happening that same weekend? And this seemed to be a little bit more macro or at least regional, you know, because I can't ask all across the country on that one. But the next piece with the market is I know everyone continues to want more information on Colubridfest. And they're I know. I get nailed with this. And for all of the listeners who I promise you are as close of a friend to me as we have always been and thought, you know, you know who you are if you're hearing this, because I've had so many friends ask me, so what city is it in? So, and I can't tell you, I'm sorry. I love you. We are close. We have just made a vow not to share it with anyone yet. But the updates that I can give you, one, we are like 95% sure that this will be the last weekend of September. So those are your dates.
Have a date.
The last weekend of September. The only way that changes is if something really screwball happens, but that's pretty much, like I said, 95% locked in.
That is the weekend of the 27th, 28th, and 29th of September.
Correct. You got it.
Yep.
The current status now is we believe we found a venue. Mickey is in negotiation with them right now. We're talking like a 20,000 square foot convention center. So, I mean, we would have plenty of room to do what we want to do in a big, big way. The holdup right now, the sales team for this hotel convention center they're stoked. You know, they're excited to be able to rent this kind of massive thing out. But we have to get all of the approvals from the management team there at the hotel, as well as the management teams from above. So more of like the, you know, we'll just say corporate for lack of a better word here. And that is because we're not just having a convention, we're actually bringing reptiles. And anytime it's animals, there's a lot more to it. And especially the fact that we're not bringing the furry, cuddly kind. So we have to get past some of those biases and fears to get the approvals. So that's where we're currently standing is if we can get the nod on all that, then we will have the venue locked in. And I think things will move at a rapid pace as soon as we get the trigger pulled there. So, so there is the Colubridfest update.
So we have a date. So we gave you new information. One thing that I'm going to ask is we do have the Saturday, which is going to be more of, you know, that's going to be presentations. Mm-hmm. We're going to be doing panels. My job is I'm taking lead on that day because I'm the scientist that goes to meetings and things, but I also don't want it to be the way a scientific conference is because I love scientific conferences. I go to scientific conferences all the time, but usually by 11 o'clock, I want to go to bed. And I want the presentations to be more of an open conversation rather than somebody is standing up there being like, this is how you take care of a corn snake. Like I think you get more out of the conversation, though there will be some people we're trying to lure in. I mean, that's the proper term that may have some name power that you might want to hear give a talk. So one request I have of the listeners, and we are 18 minutes in. So if you're at this point and you're jazzed about Colubridfest, pull the car over, stop the YouTube video, message me on Facebook or Instagram what you want those talks to be about. I have in my mind's eye what the talk should be. Clint has what he thinks the talk should be, but we're doing this for you. So while we are doing the bulk of the heavy lifting, there may be talks out there that I'm not even thinking of that you may want to give. You know, I learned this with my students recently in something I was doing in a class. So you are always allowed to send me a message. And my office phone's going off. Who the hell is calling me in my office at this time of night? Anyway, but please, please, back to the subject at hand. Instagram, Dr. Crawdad, Facebook, Zach Loafman, email, Z-L-O-U-G-H-M-A-N at westliberty.edu. I need to hear from you because I just put together the talks for IHS, and we'll be talking about that here shortly. I'm primed and ready, but I want to make sure we hit the nail on the head for what you guys want to hear about. So there you go.
Love it.
Anything else to add to that, Clint?
No. You can also message us on Kluber and Kluber Radio's Facebook.
Oh yeah,
page.
That too. Yes, you know, absolutely.
Shoot it there. You know, I think that you hit the nail on the head when you said we want to make sure that we are delivering to them what they want. You know, what our listeners yeah. want, because this is. We're doing this for the Kluber lovers. I mean, so please, you know, whatever topics, if you've got suggestions for potential panels, you know, what you think, let us know. Let us know.
Yep. Yep. Okay. I'm going to do the science update. We didn't do this last time. We'll do this kind of quick because I want to get to Ashley. But there was a paper that came out last month that's It's a great paper because it directly ties into herpetoculture, though that wasn't the purpose of the paper, but it's very easy tie-in. And it also ties into something that is in some people's eyes controversial, and other people's eyes it's controversial that it's controversial, if that makes sense, which is cohabbing. So Skinner et al., 2024, the title of the paper is Bolder Together, Conformity Drives Behavioral Plasticity in Eastern Garter Snakes. So that's a really fancy title that basically gets into this idea of change in behavior. So for this study, what the authors did, and this is part of that same group, I believe, that's doing the garter snake research that's coming out. They just had a paper come out last week that's pretty cool. I haven't read it yet, but it's probably going to be one of these updates. But what they did is they basically have clutch mates. And in animal science right now, in behavioral ecology, there's this concept of boldness. And boldness is basically defined as your willingness to leave cover, to leave safety, to then explore your environment. And the idea from an evolutionary standpoint is you should have individuals in a population that are bold, and you should have individuals in a population that are timid, and then a bunch in between. And so the bold individuals are responsible for like expanding your range, expanding your distribution, but they have a tendency to die because they're bold. So the timid ones are like, oh, hell no, I'm not going out there where the hawk is. So they're less risk averse, but because they're not expanding, you know, the likelihood of those genes making it out of the population, everything's lower, but survival rates might be higher. And then they're almost like an insurance. So by them not being so risk averse, they might get to mate, they might get to have more offspring. Okay. So there's all kinds of papers that get into which is better, which is more important, but that's not what this is about. What this paper was about is can a snake learn from its conspecific, its neighbor, how to be bold? So basically you have a timid snake that is habitually timid. If you keep it in an enclosure with a bold snake, will it basically become bold because it sees the other snake being bold, thus making it not timid? I don't think you have to be a rocket scientist to see the tie-in to herpetoculture, because we've all had those baby snakes. We talk about them all the time that are like, nope, I just choose death. Death is me, and that is what I will do. And then you have those clutch mates that are like, you know, not risk averse, and they're the ones that are ripping your pinky off. What they found, to sum this up, is that essentially the timid snakes can learn to be bold if they are kept with a bolder snake. And this shows a behavioral complexity that, of course, everybody underestimates snakes all the time. So that was a major talking point. But what I kept thinking about was this whole idea when you have a clutch of babies. You know, there's this, some people keep the whole clutch together and they feed them. Other people separate immediately into smaller tubs, smaller containers, and then they feed them. I've started to basically keep them all together because I noticed that I got a stronger feeding response due to what I anticipated to be competition. Now, you do this with king snakes. They reach a size, and you went from 8 king snakes to 6 king snakes because those timid snakes just became food. So that's not the best strategy for kings. But the nature scene keepers of the world have known this. The people that keep Nerodia and Thamnophis, we've seen this a million times over. But it was just really nice to have in publication form what we have all seen. The tie into cohabbing is, you know, the issue with that obviously is disease transfer. And it's also space, welfare concerns, all of that. But I have definitely seen this in the Thamnophis keepers of the world have a tendency to do bigger naturalistic enclosures with multiple animals in the enclosure. You always see a stronger feeding response, more behavioral response, everything when you do that. So it was just nice to see in peer-reviewed, published form, a paper that documents what many herpetoculturalists have known for a very long time. And the authors so cool. did a fantastic job. So I think this one's open access too. So if you search it, you can find it and actually download it. So that's the science update. And then the other thing, IHS. We have our talks. I will be listing the talks in our next episode because the IHS president is our guest for the next episode. Mike Clarkson, he'll be talking about Acrocordatus, the elephant trunk snakes, and then the homolopsids, which are the Asiatic water snakes. That's his jam. We're going to be bringing him on, but we're going to do our great big IHS episode, go over all the speakers. It's a really cool lineup. We have 8 presentations from some pretty big names in herpetoculture. We have people talking about the ethics of herpetoculture. We have people talking about turtles. We have an amphibian talk. We have a venomous talk. I'm, of course, doing Heterodon. And then my partner in crime, Roy, he's not doing Spilotes. He's going to be doing the monkey-tailed lizards, Polychrus, because we have a lot of snake talks, and I needed to diversify that pool. But more on IHS next episode. It's definitely happening now. We have our list. We have our commitments. So there is that. So lots of housekeeping this week. This is what happens when we don't record for a while.
Right. But what are the dates for IHS again?
I should know this right off the top of my head. It's in June. At some point in time. No, it's mid-June. I got it right here. Let me get my calendar. So here we go. It is IHS is. Oh, there it is. Jesus. Wednesday, the 19th through Saturday, the 22nd of June. So, and registration is open. It's in Knoxville. There we go. All right. Are we ready to bring on Ashley?
I think we are.
Okay.
I don't know if you guys saw it, but while we were doing this, for those who can't see this and didn't see the post on Facebook, by the time you're hearing this, Ashley's video isn't on for us. It just says A. And so I took a picture and, you know, kind of apologized for the delay. And I've already put it on Facebook saying that, you know, we're literally recording our latest episode right now. And the guest is a great one. A stands for awesome.
There we go.
Because they can't read her name anywhere. So.
Yeah. So our guest tonight, as said before, is Ashley Dazan. So Ashley, how you doing?
Good, yourself?
Good. Getting through that intro.
Woo!
Yeah.
I always feel sorry for our guest, you know, how long they have to sit there and listen to us ramble. Yeah. So.
Hey, it's quite the informative talk for, unfortunately, a Canadian that doesn't have much involved in that, but it was interesting nonetheless.
Oh, there you go. All right, Ashley. So, you know, many people know you for your importing exporting business. Can you share the name of that with everybody right now?
It's Northern Lights Reptile Imports.
Yes, there we go. And I know that I have gotten animals from you. I know Clint's gotten animals from you. So, yep. We're not only the host of the podcast, but we're also your loyal customers. So, so with that being said, it's kind of our standard issue question. Normally, I would ask, how did you get into reptiles and amphibians? But I know you've been on several podcasts, and that's been asked before. Yeah. What I want to know is, how did you get into the importation, exportation side of things? In other words, when did this go from a hobby, to a business for you? What was that process like?
Well, that's an interesting process. That still goes back ways. How old was I? I was still in high school. So I was 16 probably. And here in Canada, mangrove snakes are nearly impossible to find. Sorry, I'm just going to take one of your butt out here. So with that issue, I had to figure out how to get them. Now, eventually, I did find a captive-born Melanota from Malaysia and fell in love with the genus more than I thought I would. And one day, probably about a year later, I discovered divergence. That was a thing. And they weren't in the hobby yet at that point, to my knowledge. So I just see these photos of like herping trips in the Philippines or whatever. And there's these crazy nice blue mangroves. I'm like, is this even real? Like, does this exist? And again, this is just like 17, maybe 18 year old me surfing the web, aimlessly Googling the same thing over and over and over again, going on to like page 50 of Google kind of thing. And I ran into the terroristic website.
Website?
The terroristic. The German classifieds.
Okay.
Oh, it's all of Europe, but it's mostly German.
I'm sorry. I heard I ran into the terrorist website. Excuse me.
That's what happens when you get to page 58.
Right. It's so true too. But no, not quite the terrorist website, but terroristic.
Gotcha.
So, anyways, I was going through that website and I figured out, I better start looking on this site because there's a bunch of weird species I never knew existed. And then one day, there was a photo of a divergence in a garbage can.
Oh.
And I was like,
wow.
Huh. And it was, like, for sale. It was just, like, using, like, you know, venomous snakes going to, like, a garbage can kind of thing. Like, not a like literal trash, but, you know, just in a holding bin that was a trash can. And I was like, interesting. So I messaged a person just out of pure curiosity. I'm like, is this animal for sale? And he's like, yeah, it's still for sale. And I'm like, how much is it? He's like, 1,800 euros, which is nowadays probably around 2,000 US-ish. Okay. And I'm assuming this individual is a wild caught. But I was like, okay, I'll buy her. And he's like, okay. So I sent a deposit and he gave me like a payment plan to pay her off. But I had no idea how to get her. Not a clue. So I was just trying to figure that out and asking random people and posting on this website, you know, looking for someone who could ship to Canada for this one snake. And then I ran into somebody that was actually willing to help me. I don't know if you know of Kaya out in Poland, I think.
No.
She does a lot of venomous stuff. Kaya Kochaz or... I'm saying that very wrong, but she's a wonderful lady and she was the one that got me hooked up with an exporter in Europe. And she also offered me the first generation captive bred pair of divergence as well. So I grabbed those, of course, and then had a few friends get a couple things. And then, then that brought in my first import of 3 divergence. The first ones into North America because they were so pretty and I needed them. And that's how it started.
Wow.
And then it just kind of went from there.
So you go through that process, but was there a point in the process where you're like, I can do this?
Or
was it more of a, like, you know, all right, I did it once. Now I'm going to do it again. Now I did it 3 times. Now I'm familiar. Like, was there an evolution to it? Or was it I'm jumping off this cliff and I'm going to do this kind of thing?
It was probably about a 2.5-3 year process of just doing it with myself and a few close friends and getting connections. And then, I've been doing this 7 years now, 8 years now. And I've been solo, like as a full-time job for the last 3 years. So before I was pretty serious in doing like public sales, but I also had like a full-time job on the side. But I'd say I was doing public sales probably about, 5 years ago, I'd say. For a while it was just myself and a few friends just to kind of get the gist of it and people to kind of trust. But, you know, there's always the hiccups that happen, still do to this day. But that's what it basically turned into.
It's really neat. You know, I want to kind of, I guess, state out there why we wanted to bring Ashley specifically, you know, on for this episode. Because, you know, I think we all know that the word import has a negative connotation, you know, in our hobby, in our discipline. And it shouldn't. Don't get me wrong. There's reasons that it does, because there's been a lot of individuals out there that have given it that bad name and that bad taste. But, you know, with Ashley, you know, we've got a difference here, right? And, you know, one of the things I think that we want to kind of state is the difference between an animal being an import and being a wild caught import. You know, two substantially different things. There's a lot of captive bred animals in Europe and Canada that make its way to the U.S. because of you, Ashley, you know, right? I mean, you know, I know I've got some, I've got several, you know, at this point, it's got more coming. And I think that that's one of the things that I hope that we can kind of put out there, that just because something was imported into the United States doesn't mean it's a bad thing. You know, type. And even with wild caughts, and this is something I guess I kind of want to, you know, touch base on. Before we go any further with, because we are going to be talking about some wild caught animals and maybe some tips and whatnot, I think we should probably establish none of us are veterinarians.
Not that kind of doctor.
No. So anything that we talk about from here on with, you know, wild caught animals and whatnot, we're not taking the place of a veterinarian, not saying to not go seek veterinarian assistance. These just may be tips and pieces from some of us that just work with animals. That's all. So put that disclaimer out there, you know, beforehand. But
that's a good idea.
cover some butts here. So, you know, Ashley, you know, I look and I've seen where it looks like a lot of, or the majority of what I see you offering are captive bred animals, but I do see where you'll work with some wild caughts too. And one of the reasons we wanted to bring this on or to discuss this is because obviously every reptile in the hobby, its species is in the hobby because at some point there were wild caughts that were brought in and captive populations established. And so I think that, you know, I it's still important that wild caughts do have a place, you know, in the hobby to some degree. You know, I think we would all recommend to anyone listening that if you have a captive bred option, go that option. But wild caughts certainly help bring more species into the hobby that don't exist in the hobby yet. And that seems like what a lot of the wild caught animals I see that you ever have available tend to be are the things that you really don't see anywhere else. Am I correct in that assumption?
You're pretty much correct. Yep.
Yeah. And that seems awesome. So what has led you to the obscure? You know, what's taken you that direction?
So I'm going to make a quick tidbit on something you said earlier. My driving force is that stereotype of an importer, because the whole wild caught side of things, right? Everyone brings in the common wild caught stuff, and you know the drill. I'm not going to get into it. You know what it is. Everyone knows what it is. That's my driving force. So I do mostly advertise captive bred, and especially uncommon stuff. I try to stay away from the more common stuff because in the hobby, it's quite saturated already. And people need, and this goes with the wild card stuff too, people need to discover what else is out there. And this day and age, again, this ties with the whole wild card conversation of the obscurities. And the reason behind it is that they, end of the day, need protection. So, yes, to a very tiny percentage, the pet trade does affect the wild population. However, we all know deforestation, local medicines or food markets, whatever, those also diminish population.
Correct, yeah.
And I'm trying not to be a negative Nancy, but over time, the way things have been going within Europe, within Canada, and I don't know so much in the States, but the governments are really trying to stop the pet trade, at least with import and exports. Mm-hmm. So my goal, especially with the wild caught stuff and the uncommon captive breds, is to establish them into our designated countries and get populations going. So you know what? We don't have to get more wild caughts in.
Yeah.
We can get them established into our hobby. People get to learn about them and how amazing other species are. And in turn, that helps us learn about them too. The stuff I keep, I'd say 90% wild caught stuff myself that I've imported. But I'm here to learn about them. I'm not here to breed them. I'm not here to make a dime off of them, but I want to learn about them to be able to give that knowledge to other people who do want to decide to bring them in as well. So that's my take on bringing the wild caught stuff and why I offer the more obscure things. And I don't sell them to just anybody either. I often, if I don't know the person, I'll screen them to see if they even know how to take care of that genus or anything related to make sure they have that capability of keeping them. But that's really the gist of why I offer wild caught. It's not my most favorite thing because it comes at a risk, an endless amount of risks, as we know. But I do my best with them when they come in and try and get them to the customer or whoever is buying them or keeping them as healthy as possible so they have the best chance as well as the animal.
Yeah. You know, I think you actually kind of just inadvertently answered my next question that I was wanting to ask. It's because, you know, like we stated, importation has this negative stigma, you know, with it. However, you've managed to develop a very positive reputation, you know, in that arena. And I was going to ask, you know, what you attributed that to, but I think your answer just now kind of shows, you know, what contributed to that. And in fact, you know, another thing to your point of with wild caught carrying, you know, these inherent risks, that's one thing I've always noticed whenever when you have wild caught animals that are available or going, usually when they're going to be available, you specifically point that out, not just that they're wild caught. You state these will carry the same risks. You know, these will carry, I don't remember exactly how you phrase it, but something along the lines of all the risks that wild caught come with.
Yes.
You know, so you mentioned that and point that out again. And, you know, I really respect that. So that's another great piece. So, you know, while we're on the conversation of wild caught, and again, to reiterate, if you've got the chance to go captive bred, do that. But if you are someone who is, you know, if I'm going to take on a new project, a species that, let's say, is very rare in the hobby or new to the hobby, and I want to kind of take my shot at it, what advice do you have for someone who is taking on wild caught animals for the first time? Like, what are some steps? What are some watch outs? Things like that.
So I have two tiers when it comes to this. With the more common stuff, it's very straightforward. Have your quarantine. don't stress the animal out. Mm-hmm. Basically, for most keepers, have your vet do fecals, and if they have mites, treat accordingly for mites or remove ticks. Hydration is key first and foremost. As soon as you get the animal, hydration, hydration, hydration. That is so important. Worry about food after. And I know people be like, oh, but if it's skinny, it needs food. You will kill the animal if you try and feed it right away. Especially if they're quite emaciated. I personally do a smoothie mixture for the first few weeks to get their gastrointestinal tract up and going and gut flora going. Because let's put it this way. If you have a really, really bad week of the flu and you're puking your guts out, you're not eating a big meal right away. It's not going to go well. And that's the example I use with most people. So don't shove food down an underweight snake's mouth. That's wild caught. Just get it hydrated, get it settled, go from there. And if you have a good vet, have them work through it with you. And then from there, if it's healthy already when you get it, just quarantine it for a couple months. Make sure he's healthy. Make sure he's eating, hydrated. And then you can introduce it at that point into your collection. The second tier of wild caughts would be the more complicated species like Chironia pseudoxenodon, some cryptic Boega. Those guys are a much higher risk wild caught, and not so much for sensitivities once established or issues, but sensitivities of when they go from wild to sterile quarantine, they die. And my experience, especially with Chironius, would be anytime they went to sterile, it's 100% death rate. So I tinkered with that for a while, and I essentially have a quarantine area that's naturalistic, and it gets cleaned out completely once they get moved out, but it's plants, it's leaf litter, it's soil, moving water, and I make sure they don't have like any mites or anything, and if they're clear of that from what I see, they go straight into there, so it's as if they really didn't quite leave their natural habitat as much as it would be going into a sterile tub or something. Mm-hmm. And I've had the best success with a lot of the high-strung cryptic wild caughts that way long-term. So that's not something I recommend the average person doing or getting into unless you really know what you're doing.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
You mentioned, having feet. What are some of the things, and I ask this just because, a lot of times fecals, they can't check for everything. You kind of have to say these are the things that you want checked. Are there any common things that you ask or that you would recommend that, an individual has the fecal run for?
This is going to sound weird, but it actually depends where the animal's from.
No, that makes complete sense. Yeah. That's a great piece to go into. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not so much a fecal in this case. I mean, the common things like tapeworms or pinworm, whatever, I don't think pinworm's really much of a snake issue more than lizards. But with a lot of snakes I deal with anyway, the thing to actually have to worry about is lungworm.
Can I ask a question on that real quick?
Yeah.
When you say lungworm, are you is that a pentastome you're talking about, or is it a
that or flukes?
Okay, I was going to say is it a fluke or a pentastome?
Yeah, it depends on the location issue at that point. So Asian species tend to be fluke quite often in my experience, especially from China. South America, I've noticed, can be the pentastomes, and then internally, gastrointestinal wise, it's hookworm.
Mm.
So, which they're not easy things to get rid of, not easy things to test for always. So when it comes to like the hookworm, that's like a multifecal test situation. And the problem with hookworm is they're quite resistant to a lot of medications. Mm. It's Same when it comes to like the pentastomes and fluke. The fluke is really easy to deal with. Like I find Praziquantel does that pretty good job with them. But the latter with the pentastomes is usually it's just symptomatic treatments with them because you can't really get rid of them without risking killing the snake. So a lot of those animals, it's not easily transmissible to, in my experience and a few friends' experiences. Basically, it's something, if I could be wrong, but I think it's through whatever they eat. Like if it's a frog eater or something.
Yeah,
or,
that's right.
Yeah. Yeah. So transmission is not so much of like a high risk with other snakes, but management of the snake that has it is crucial in terms of don't stress them out. So goniosoma are famous for it. They get these so-called respiratory infections that aren't actually respiratory infections. Same with Dendrolophus. So every time you move them into a new enclosure, they stress out and they start salivating and breathing and having issues like as if they have a respiratory infection, but they don't. It's actually just the worms kind of stressing them out, acting up because they are stressed. So keeping them as minimally stressed as possible has the symptoms go away. It's very strange. I'm actually, those are the type of things I personally have to deal with. So like I still deal with fecals, but that's just like the more the common stuff to look out for. I focus more on the scarier stuff with my guys personally.
No, that makes complete sense. This is going to be a little bit of a tangent, but it's something that I just remembered because you said something about a frog eater. And I know, Zach, this goes into your wheelhouse, too, with something that one of your students is working on. But Ashley, you were making a type of feed, if I remember right. Yeah, right. Talk about that for just a second.
Okay. So once upon a time, I had way too many Chironius and Scurrilus specifically are obligate frog eaters.
Right?
Yes, correct. Yeah. Yes. And I had this female. Oh, my God. So the smaller ones were an issue, but this girl was around 7.5 feet. She died of old age with me, unfortunately. But the time I had her for several years. So, you know, big American bullfrogs, like if I was to put it into perspective, she could eat three of those.
Wow.
And obviously that's not very accessible as a food source, at least in Canada. So it's a lot of importing golden tree frogs, Arachophorus leucomystax, which gets expensive when you have to feed a frog eater with a high metabolism every week or twice a week. So I had to figure out an alternative. While she would eat bullfrog legs you could buy at the grocery store, it's not whole prey. It's not sustainable long term.
Right.
And so I had to figure that out. And I decided, you know, one day I should just grind up a bunch of frog legs with whole ground up chicken and find a way to mold it together. And she ate it. I mean, it took years, several years to figure out a good mixture, like to keep it together, we'll say. But I've had 100% success with that genus eating this frog mixture mash. And the reason why, I'm sure people are like, well, why don't you feed rodents? They don't eat rodents. I will not feed them rodents because they're not supposed to eat rodents. Their body is not built for that.
There you
and
go.
And I did, just for the terrible experiment of it, I had a hairless rat and I tied it to a frog just to see what would happen. It was a small rat, too. She ate it. 3 days later, she regurgitated the rat intact, but the frog was gone.
Wow.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So to me, that is, this snake definitely cannot digest at least heavily fatty rodents. It's just not in their program, I guess we'll say, to be able to do that. So other snakes maybe that can digest it but shouldn't be eating them, what does that do to them?
Right. Right.
Right?
Yeah. So, and you're barking up a tree. I'll let you finish, but then I'm going to go ahead.
Oh, you're good. But yeah, so with that, I've kind of expanded to like gecko and, oh, I said frog and just like fish and invert for like monitors. So they stop being fed heavily rodent diets. And yeah. Yeah.
And that's I thought it was even neat because weren't you like molding them into
dead frog shapes?
Yeah. Just thought that was funny. They even look like frogs.
So. Yeah. No, there's so much to this. One of the things that I'm doing with hognose snakes right now is, you know, feeding them the rodents. And I feel like I need to give myself lashes because I'm watching them eat the rodents. And then I'm like, but we just did that damn study where we learned how to do the sausages. Should we be doing the sausages? Like every flipping time I feed one, that's rolling in the back of my brain. The Nasicus, the Westerns, that's or Plains hognose, whatever you want to call it, they're a little different. They eat more rodents than people realize. But they're not, now, please, for the love of God, don't take that and run with it and be like, Loafman said they eat more rodent. Like, I'm not saying that. You know, but like, I have Southerns, Mexicans, and the Easterns here too. And yeah, we're probably heading down the sausage line here very shortly. Like what we did with the indigo snake. So are you, but my question is, I remember seeing this on, I think it was on your Facebook page. Is this stuff just like unconsolidated or are you putting it in some kind of a casing?
So, I don't know if I want to give out that much information.
It's all right, we won't give that information.
That's fair.
It's
that's
okay.
Fair.
It's okay. It's not in a casing. It's all natural. I'll just say it, whatever, because people have to figure it out. It's very difficult. It's basically, it's like a beef gelatin I'm using.
Oh, hold it together.
Gotcha.
Interesting.
Yes, but it's very minimal, and depending on the ingredients I'm using, it's plus or minus how much I use in that to hold it together. But it's such a small amount in comparison to everything else, it's nearly non-existent. So I know there is a similar company that kind of does the same thing. We all know what we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. And I've looked into it, and there's actually a place in Europe that tried it too. They use, I don't know if it's everything in the main company, but the few people I've asked and looked into, it's a vegetarian-based collagen. Hmm. It's a fake, it's synthetic, which is usually agar. Now, I can't confirm that's really what it is. But it's a little weird to me to use a heavily vegetation binder, we'll say.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, again, I don't know if that's a thing still or if that's really truly the case, but I just stick to pure meat, I guess. I don't know what I'm talking about, but actual animal product, right? So that's the only so-called, I guess, byproduct I use, but everything else is completely whole prey.
And is this something
other than the bullfrog legs, but
is this something you're still tinkering with? Or are you making this available to the public? Where are you at with this?
Oh, this is totally available to the public now. I get several orders a week here in Canada.
But say, I'm sure is it still just there in Canada?
Oh, yeah. So unfortunately, you have to deal with the Canada Food Inspection Agency as well as USDA,
yeah.
Right? Because it's still a raw meat product under the day. So that's a whole new thing to kind of get over. I have to ask them more about that because apparently you could import and export frozen rodents without issues, without permits. So I don't know about this, but I was considering, I've talked to a couple people in the States. I'm still humming and hawing and depends on their time frame. But basically I could have someone in the States do the same thing.
It's funny because my mind was going that same direction, Ashley.
Yeah, and just like get like a percentage, just send up whatever, you know, business-wise.
Right,
but
right.
They run the main U.S. side of it. That would be fine with me. It's just, yeah, like, so I've considered doing it that way. So that way it's all U.S. everything, right? It's, I don't have to worry about the importation or exportation process because it's just going to cost way too much to do it that way.
Yeah. That makes complete sense. You know, I love that you've done this. I mean, because again, I knew Zach was going to be real interested, you know, when bringing that topic up, because I know that he's, you know, has the student there that's been working on the same thing. And this is, again, it seems like every episode we hit some topic that just gets me excited, because it's moving more towards taking care of these animals in ways we haven't in the past.
Yes.
You know, where instead of it just being about convenience for us, it's more about what's more natural and better for that animal. You know, we talk about lighting, we talk about temps, we talk about caging, and we talk about diversifying food. But, you know, to be able to do something like this where in one package they're getting a diversified meal.
Yeah, it is. And it's all whole prey on top of it all.
Yeah, yeah.
The whole prey piece is what's good.
Yeah, absolutely. So very cool. And, you know, kudos to you for taking the effort to figure that out and to, you know, really come through with it. So nicely done. Nicely done. Zach, is there anything else on imports or Ashley, is there anything from you that you think that, you know, listeners would like to know, or any of the behind the scenes, or just, you know, anything else that we don't commonly think of, or myths or anything like that when it comes to importation?
Well, the thing is, I can't really say anything about myths because I'm quite different compared to most. Mm-hmm. But end of the day, there's always going to be the similar, I don't want to say similar issues or risks, but there's always going to be risks with importation because I cannot control the care of other people's animals, right? Mm-hmm. And people get upset with me sometimes about that, like, oh, you're supposed to be good quality, blah, 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 compared to other importers. Like, this is like one in several hundred that this happens. But it's like, I can't control the care of these animals prior. I do my best. If it's in bad health, I'm not going to send it to you. I'm going to have my vet deal with it at my cost. Mm-hmm. So that's really the only thing I would have to put out there. But past that, like, I go out of my way to deal with everything, take care of everything. I feed everything. Myth wise, I guess not everything is wild caught when it comes to imports.
Right. Right. And I think that was, you know, is a big thing that more and more people are starting to understand that in the past, probably 10 years, you know, than previously, because it's that anytime you heard the word import, it was wild caught. That's how everybody's mentality was. And I think now we are a global market.
That we are.
You know, that's the way that it has to be thought about. And there are animals produced in different countries that I know there. And Ashley, again, correct me if I'm wrong. This may be, as you heard, we do the market update, right? And that's my side. But obviously, a lot of the market update is going to be U.S. specific. Now, I may have some feelers in some of the other areas, but as I was mentioning to Zach when we were trying to figure out all the podcast recording technical issues we were having at the beginning, I said that one of the things I like about having you on is you probably got a stronger feel for some of the global market than what I do, because you're dealing with, you know, these people from all over the world. Now, Asian rat snakes, for example, it, from what I am getting and feeling, there's not quite as strong of a market for Asian rat snakes in Canada as there is in the U.S. Is that factual?
Yeah. Canada's stuck in the ball pythons, crested geckos, and leopard gecko phase still. We're getting there. We're getting there slowly.
No, I get it. And at the same time, is it fair to say that in Europe, have they almost gotten bored with Asian rat snakes?
Oh, it's actually, the Asian rats are still quite common out that way. I'd say it's definitely booming more in the States right now.
Gotcha.
For sure.
And that's kind of what, you know, I felt it. And the whole reason I asked that is when we talk about imports, that's what I mean, is something that someone may be producing in one area of the world, or we're just going to use bamboo rats, for example.
Okay.
You know, they're going to be produced in several areas of the world. Obviously, people are using them. But right now, the United States is where they're the most popular. Mm-hmm. And so it's, I guess I want to put out there to people that there are, since we are a global market, it's just like moving one thing from California to your grocery store in Indiana, where, you know, we don't produce avocados in Indiana kind of thing, but they have to get shipped over. So that's kind of what a lot of this is now, is there's a lot of captive bred importing and exporting to simply take the supply to where the demand is.
Yeah, pretty much.
So if there, can you give us an idea, just before we move past all the importation, what is popular wear? What do you see?
So that changes quite often. So if I'm looking at my imports alone, it's literally different every shipment, but there's always a big something. Like 2 years ago, house snakes were like all the rage. And then beauty snakes were all the rage. Mm-hmm. And then Rankin's dragons, for whatever reason, were all the rage. And it just goes into cycles. But as a whole with countries, Europe is, in my opinion, worlds ahead in terms of understanding husbandry of more uncommon species. And when you talk about the Asian rat snakes and that, how they're more popular in the States now, I don't want to say Europe has moved on from them, but they are more focusing on the up-and-coming, more difficult species. Mm-hmm. And this kind of goes back to the whole conversation of me offering the wild-caught stuff for people to learn and understand and acknowledge they actually exist. It's that same mentality of that's what they're trying to pursue and understand and learn these species to get them into the hobby. And... yeah. Sorry, keep going.
No, I was going to say, I think that doesn't surprise me at all, because I think that Europe tends to be further ahead of us when it comes to understanding ultraviolet, you know, UVB. They were using that, naturalistic setups, you know, all that. They're further advanced when it comes to caging than what we are as a whole in the United States.
Yeah.
You know, we certainly have people who are doing great work with it, but, you know, from one, you know, country to another kind of thing, they certainly are ahead of us in that game.
Yeah, and the big player, a lot of people don't realize this is actually a thing. So I'm just going to start this sounding a little strange, but a lot of people, especially in the States, some in Canada as well, they assume, like, Europe is, like, one of the biggest smuggling countries because of all the species they have available. Now, there's a bit of like a bittersweetness to that. It's not quite true to the degree people are thinking. So, and this is where this all comes into play. Zoos play a huge role in the private sector in Europe. Whereas in Canada and the USA, we don't have this.
No.
Animals at a zoo in Europe, once they're produced, can be sold privately or given to a private keeper who then can sell them to other private keepers. So I was at when I went to Europe recently, there was a zoo there I went to. They had some, Mitchelli, Varanus Mitchelli, which, coolest creatures. Like, they're a mix of like a water monitor and a Timor monitor, in size and activity. Like, they're arboreal, but they're highly aquatic. Never seen them in my life. And they're like one of the only ones in captivity right now. The moment these produce, CITES will give them legal documentation of their origin, and thus making them a legal specimen, especially all their babies. So once they produce, those babies will have documentation to move on to the new designated owners, and thus making them legal. So Europe has a lot of odd species that normally would not be deemed legal anywhere else because of that.
That's really interesting. I never even thought of that as being one of the, but man, that's actually a significant difference. That, yes, the zoos are kind of, you know, a hand-in-hand piece with the hobbyist. I mean, you can see why it would grow. You know, certain species would jump at a much faster rate over there than over here, because that's not the case. here. No. I mean, there may be some zoos that work a little bit with, you know, somebody private, but it's definitely not anything on a big scale, you know, like that. So that's interesting. I had no idea. Did you know that, Zach?
I was aware of it to a certain extent. And every country is a little bit different, too. But I know that some of the animals that we have, that's how we got them, is it was imported into the zoo, then the zoo produced them, and then the zoo, you know, released to the private sector, and then imported from the private sector in Europe to here, and now North America has it.
Very interesting. Huh. That kind of puts a new pin on the – is that something we can – we can start to change here in the States, Zach. Mm-hmm. So, because that's, yeah.
Well,
that's
it's interesting. It's definitely interesting because it's, you know, some of these from a conservation point of view, because I live in that world, you know, and kind of what Ashley was alluding to, I do think it's important for like Varanus michelii as an example. I don't think that those should necessarily just go to anybody who can buy them. You know, if the goal is really to establish a captive population for herpetoculture in a private sector, they need to get in the hands of the people who then can work with them and produce them. Mm-hmm. And exactly. Oftentimes yeah. What happens is those particular taxa become like almost like a trophy. Like, you know, I've got the money that I can own these things. I mean, the classic example outside of our area, but still a snake, are Bolin's pythons, yeah. You know, because they look really, really cool with a cool Instagram filter, and you can, you know, have your whole I'm one with nature holding the Bolin eye, whatever the hell that crap is. But, you know, when you buy those one-offs, those are not getting in the hands of the people that can actually produce Bolin eye, mm-hmm. then make Bolin eye to crack the code, if you will. To then make it so that they're not $10,000 and that, you know, they might drop down to $2,000. Now we have a captive population and we don't have to be removing babies from from the wild. But at the same time, though, you know, if they do get in, so I'm in charge of the zoo science major here. Obviously, I'm pro zoo, but I've talked to a lot of people in the zoo world who have said to me, there's one thing to when you do this stuff in the zoo world, you have bureaucracy and red tape, and that serves a purpose. When it gets to the private sector, that kind of goes away, and you can kind of, it's more of a passion driven exercise, maybe, mm-hmm. which might lead to a better result. And I'm going to stop talking. So anyway,
I think you also make a great point where it's, you know, when I'm referring to. I would love to see zoos. It just goes back to what we've said is one of our missions here, and that is helping to bridge the gap between academia and, you know, the hobbyist. And if we could have more of our accredited zoos that are producing animals, putting these in the hands of capable individuals, just like you said. Yes. Not just when I said the public, I don't just mean the general public. I'm meaning it's almost like a tiered system kind of thing.
Yeah.
You give it to the people that can really do something with these animals. And as they do more, it gets into the hands of the people who are now learning these animals and you know, just growing it.
And before we go too far off in the weeds, but the turtle people have figured this out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
On the turtle side of things, we have the Asian turtle crisis, which obviously we don't talk about on Clubroy Radio that much. But, you know, it got to mission critical where when you're intercepting these importations of turtles to be literally turned into folk medicine in Asia, and now we have 1,000 of them, no zoo is able to take 1,000 turtles mm-hmm. with the budgets that they have to deal with. And so it became... we got to figure out, you know, what to do with these animals. We can't euthanize them necessarily, especially if they're imperiled. And so the issue of the private keeper versus zoo versus even federal and state agency, that was really kind of shoved in everybody's. We didn't have the time for the walls to go up. A decision had to be made and people had to figure out how to make that work. And so precedents have been set. And that's part of the reason why at the university I think I talked about this maybe once, we're doing turtle work here now because it fulfills that kind of magical world that I want to dwell in, where it's a third, a third, a third, or a quarter, a quarter, a quarter, where the agencies, the private sector, academia, and the zoos are all working together, which is the way it freaking should be, towards a common goal. But the other thing that gets into this, and I'll stop it at this, is everybody has an ego, whether we like it or not. A great example is, like, I work with the OCIC and Dr. Bogan at OCIC, who's a incredibly badass reptile vet. He's the guy that we worked with to develop the sausage. He's the person that's breeding the Eastern indigos for release. Totally scientific. But I've heard people in the private side of things just trash OCIC. They don't know how to produce an indigo snake. They don't know how to, like, and I just sit there and think, like, well, the private sector doesn't have a clue what it actually takes to maintain a captive population of organisms and maintain genetic heterogeneity so that you don't have a giant inbred mess. Because that's what, is another part of this thing. So everybody has something to bring to the table. It's just everybody needs to be nice and put their axes down and realize that. And that's where the problem comes, in my opinion. But with that being said, now that we've really gone down a tangent, I want to bring it back, because we talked about how there is an example of a snake that you have been successful with, that is, we only have them because of wild caughts right now. I don't know how often these guys have been bred, if they've been bred at all in human care. I think they've been bred a couple times. But let's head down and introduce our listeners to an absolutely wonderful genus of Asiatic snakes, which are colubroids, by the way, not colubrids. The most modern group, modern taxonomy of modern snakes shows that these guys are in their own family now, by some people's definition, the Pseudoxenodontidae. But that would be the genus Pseudoxenodon. So how the hell did you get into a position where you could get these things? I know that they're delicate, but they're one of those things that once they get established, we can maybe question that. But I just want to, I want the origin story. So how, when did these get on your radar, and how did you acquire them? Just kind of do the fun part there. If you don't mind.
When they got on my radar, that's a good question. I don't know, actually, but it's been, oh God, at least 6-7 years. They have definitely been a wish list species that I thought can't really ever happen, because I've always read, like, how impossible they are to work with. And they maybe last 3 months, if that. My very first introduction to them was about 5 years ago. Yeah, I'd say 5 years ago. Maybe 6 years ago. And I had a melanistic looking female Macrops. And I tried to go naturalistic with her. She would not eat for me no matter what I tried. But at the time, I only had access to bullfrog legs. And this was just dumb me, not quite understanding how serious and how naturalistic you actually have to go with them. And so bullfrog legs were a no-go. Anything frog-esque was a no-go. Aquatic frogs didn't work either. And so I was assist feeding her. I kept her naturalistic. I had like an AC right next to the enclosure to keep it cold. She lived for about 4 or 5 months with me, and I discovered I was severely allergic to bamboo that way. So I had bamboo in her enclosure. So I had to sell her. Because it was too much for me at the time. And that was that. So I was like, you know what? That's just too much. I couldn't figure it out. Move on. But I was just so determined to figure out what it is about them that's so difficult. So I wanted to give it another shot. And I got offered a group. This is going to be some brutal real life information, by the way. Yep. Some people are probably going to hate this. I got offered, I would say it was 10 Macrops and no, 16 pseudoxenodon macrops. I brought them in. They're all quite young. I'd say probably around a year and a half to 2 years old. The sexes were nearly 50-50 split. They all did quite well on live green tree frogs, and I had an enclosure set up for them about 3 months in advance. I put running water, I put a bunch of live ferns, cork on top of cork, but I buried the cork into the ground so they could hide but be really cold at the bottom of the enclosure. But then I stacked it higher, so if they wanted to be hidden but warmer, closer to the light, they had that option. But yeah, I had running water, and basically you couldn't see them in the enclosure unless they were in the front of the glass. So it was just UVB and LED, and that was it. They were in the basement, and I had the setup probably between 65 and 75 degrees, roughly. Humidity bounced between 60 to 80%. They did quite well for quite a while. I did have a few casualties, which to be expected with wild caughts.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then I moved, and then unfortunately where I moved, I couldn't get the temperature warm enough. Cold enough. So I did lose quite a few due to that. So they're very temperature sensitive. That is a confirmed thing in my experience. And then I was left with a pair by the end of it all. So I was able to figure it all out, and I moved again, and I got them into a good enclosure. It was naturalistic. Like, I had the original setup going. Temperatures are pretty good. And I even had courting activity finally from my male to my female. Mm. And which was really exciting. But one day I fed the male and he ate the frog sideways and he killed himself.
Wow. Wow.
Of all the ways. You know. So then I was left with one female and she's still going strong 3 years later. Then I had an opportunity to get 3 more macrops. Apparently it was 1.2 and 10 bambusicola. So I was like, okay, score. Let's do it. Let's try it. Let's give it a go. So as soon as I got them, the bambusicola, which seems to be a pattern, were quite dismal, we'll put it. Severely dehydrated. Some of them had like swollen faces from some sort of infection in their Duvenoy's gland. Mm-hmm. Duvenoy's gland. I can never pronounce that word.
It's all good.
But I don't know why that happens, but a good chunk of them had that. Antibiotics and Medicam did help get rid of it, thankfully, for most of them. But they had to get slurry food every single day, some twice a day. And I did have to do a light worming on them immediately with fenbendazole, as well as the other one my vet gave me. It was like praziquantel. I don't have it anymore. I have to double check what it was. But it's not quite prazi. It's not as strong as praziquantel. But it's to kill all the flukes without damaging their system because of how weak they were. And so that was, depending on the medication, it was either once a week or every 2 weeks. With the slurry, I was giving them for a solid 4 months, for 2 months. And I'd be weighing them every single day to see if they needed more or less. And I had about half of the bambusicola did pass because they were just in such terrible condition. They're getting subcutaneous fluids 3 times a day. And this is all under vet recommendation, by the way, just so in case anyone's wondering. And by the end of it, I had 3 survive. Go figure. All females. And I had the one that was struggling to hold weight, she did pass from, she got that swollen face thing again. No one could figure out what it was. My vet was doing bacterial swabs and nothing was showing up for some reason. But she didn't want to actually go into the face and, you know, cause more damage and stress. So I was left with 2. They're both were doing really, really well. And then I moved their enclosure location. I don't know what the difference was, but the female blew up. The other female blew up in her face, and she just lost weight and died.
Oh.
So it was the weirdest thing. On the side note, the three macrops ended up being Carl Schmidt eye. They were actually macrops. I was sad about that. They went to a friend of mine. I didn't want to deal with another species. They're doing fine. But yeah, so I have now one bamboo cicola and one macrops. Doing phenomenal. Phenomenal. But they're both girls.
Well, I think that's actually a really good story because this is what you do, right?
Yeah.
And back when Matt was, you know, on and he would talk about establishing file snakes or the red bamboo snake. They're not rabbit. Mm-hmm. Red and black striped snakes, whatever those things were.
Yeah, the African ones there.
Yeah. And he talked about if you're going to commit yourself to one of these taxa, you're going to commit yourself to, you know, at the ground level, trying to establish them, you have to deal with the imports.
Yes.
And this is, you know, this is the reality. When you deal with snakes that eat amphibians,
there's a lot to them.
There's a lot to that hot mess of parasitic wonderment.
Yep.
So, and these guys are amphibian obligates for most of their life. So,
They are. So they will not touch bullfrog legs. They will not touch my frog sausages. I've gotten my bamboo cicola to eat them occasionally if I scent it pretty good with a frog. My macrops will not touch them. But they will take frozen thawed without question.
Hmm. Frozen thawed frogs?
So that's a yes.
Wow.
So they're good with that, which, thank goodness, it's getting even fresher wild caughts. They're pretty good on eating frozen thawed quite readily. I've had the odd one be a little picky, but for the most part, they've always readily taken frozen thawed. So a lot of the times I'd hide the medication in the frog if they were eating right away to treat them. But yeah, so they'd always get two rounds instead of like just one whatever round of wormer. I'd go through two rounds, sometimes three, a few months down the road, just to make sure their systems are absolutely flushed. But they, you know what? Once they're established and acclimated, and you keep their husbandry pretty spot on, they're fantastic.
Yeah.
Absolutely fantastic. Very bold snakes. They're just another one of those snakes where you cannot have a sterile quarantine.
Yep. Well, so the reason why I love them is, we've got to get a little bit into the science because I was so excited to talk about them that I realized there's probably a lot of people listening to this, or not some people, that are like, what the hell is Pseudoxenodon? So this is a genus of snakes that's endemic to Asia. And in Asia, they're kind of they're known to live in cool, temperate forests in mesic environments, so like wet environments. So this is, you know, they make their way down into Thailand and places like that, but they have a tendency to be in environments that are, you know, 60 to maybe 80, but 80 is pushing it for these guys. So think cocci for all of you that, you know, take care of Asiatic rat snakes that you got to keep cool. But they were put in the genus Pseudoxenodon because Xenodon is a genus that is native to South America. And you all might know it listening for Xenodon pulcher, which is the tricolor hognose snake. But another snake was in the genus Xenodon. My favorite, false water cobras used to be Xenodon gigas. So the Asiatic Pseudoxenodon do a lot of the behaviors that the giant, massive Hydrodynastes, formerly in Xenodon, false water cobras do. They hood. When they get upset, they have a thanatosis response. Some of them, they'll play dead if you push them a little bit. They're in the same kind of wet environment. That's where the amphibians kind of come into play. And the big difference between them and Hydrodynastes, other than the fact that Hydrodynastes are gigantic and Pseudoxenodon aren't necessarily giant snakes, they're, you know, moderate in size, is that Pseudoxenodon, you know, color patterns are insane. These things are really, really cool looking snakes. You were mentioning Bambusicola. That thing in the first pictures I saw of that one, I literally thought, like, this is a snake that came from the planet Endor. I like, Ewoks live where this thing evolved. Like, that, it doesn't look, I mean, it's one of those snakes that's just so cool with its you know, color pattern. And so they kind of have this natricid, viperid, dipsadid look. They are definitely their own thing, and they're rear fanged. That's the other thing that everybody needs to know. And
so I have a fun little fact about the teeth after.
There we go. Go for it. So that was just my introduction to make sure people knew why I consider them a holy grail of the potential of herpetoculture. So there you go. What's your story about the teeth?
I have my little learning fascination of snakes, like doing necropsies if they pass away. And one of the bambusicolas passed away, and I was like, let's kind of take some skin and scale away from the face and look at the gland. So from the bottom of the eye back, I totally like took all the scales off and everything to expose the muscle and the gland and the teeth and everything. So I noticed there was like a ligament between attached to the tooth and the back of the jaw. So I would push the nose up and this ligament would flex the tooth and just shoot it out forward.
Cool.
Wow.
So much like a front fang, like viperid, that the teeth are mobile, their rear fangs are mobile. It folds back, and when the snout got pushed up, it shot forward. That just like cool. When a rattlesnake opens its mouth, right? It's pulling on that ligament to pull the teeth forward. It was doing the same thing.
Yeah. Well,
coolest thing. I have a video of it. I took a video of it.
I want to see that video. I'm telling you that right now.
I'll find it. I have it on Facebook somewhere.
but one of the things that people need to know is I oftentimes talk about the fact that false water cobras may be the easiest damn snakes on earth to breed. I've literally sexed them before when I'm like, you know, you're supposed to be a male. I put them in with a known female, no response. It was probed wrong. I just literally put two females together to cohab them here in this office. And I heard the thrashing and I was like, well, that one was sexed wrong. And sure enough, there was an incredibly frustrated male that finally got to do what he was made to do. Cause I thought he was a female for the past 4 years. But Hydrodynasties back in the day, in the '80s and the '90s, if you read, which I obviously did for the book, they were at the exact same place Xenodon is right now. Like everybody talked about, they were only imported. You basically got them to die. Like you would pay money and they were infested with pentastomes. They were infested with flukes. They had tapeworms that were epic. But once we got a couple of them to breed in human care and we established that captive population now, you know, I have 18 of them. So, and other people do. So, you know, one day, hopefully, Pseudoxenodon will, you know, be on that plane. But it's people like you that are putting the work in trying to
just
get the things
finding
to,
them.
Yes. And that's the big problem with the Hydrodynasties back in the day when they shut down Brazil. They just dried up. So how often are they imported? I mean, I can't imagine this being something that survives the importation process well, not because of the importers, but because of the fact that like out in the wild, when they're collected, they probably spend time in a bag or a
correct.
Box,
so they're not,
and they're just languishing.
Well. So. Correct. So I've seen how they're kept, unfortunately, until they're purchased. And that is the ultimate killer, unfortunately. And I'm not happy with how that is. I don't like participating in that. But it's one of those lesser of the two evils where they're going to get sold or dead. They're going to die or something, regardless at this point. They're caught. They're in these in these bins. They're not getting let go. So either I'm going to buy them if I can afford to, or some random that doesn't know how to keep them because they're cool is going to buy them. So I just suck it up and do it and cry a little bit after the fact. But it's the hints of them pop up maybe a couple times a year, but to have a successful import of them actually coming in, maybe once every 2 to 3 years.
Gotcha.
Which is, kills my soul, because like thankfully my female Macrops is still young, but she's not going to be young forever, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I really, really need a male for her. It kills me. Like, really need a male.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's that.
No, I was doing what you were doing with Pseudoxenodon with Erythrolampris typhlus, the velvet swamp snakes.
Yeah.
I kind of made my mind up that that was going to be my contribution, and I was in the middle of Dipsadded time writing the book. And you are better than me, because after I went through the process you were talking about, on the, like, I don't know, eighth snake, and I had to have a completely different room and all that. I mean, at the, you know, I decided at this time in my life, it is not the time to do this.
Yeah, it's soul crushing, honestly.
But it is soul crushing, and it's hard. And I don't think, you know, people over romanticize the process. We say this phrase, you know, if you deal with life, you also deal with death. And oh my God, the typhlus, when I was trying to get those guys established, it was the most frustrating thing on earth, because they would eat. They were actually easy to get to eat. And I was feeding them Reptilink sausages and the occasional frog leg. And I was giving them the occasional pink and fish and, you know, and they would just be going, going, going. And as soon as I would think, I got them, this one's going to go, it would be dead. You know, and it's just maddening. So you're doing the Lord's work when you do this kind of stuff. Because it's almost like, oh, it's going too well, now it's going to die. Like, that was literally the way that it would work. So, but anyway, thank you. This has been an absolutely excellent episode. And we will definitely be having you back on if we can have you in the future. So I'm certain. I would love to have a Chironius episode. I think that would be great. Machete.
We should.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I have a whole other story for those. So yeah, we should.
We can save it for that. I don't remember which species it might have been. It's the one that's blue and yellow. I don't know if that's Scutellatus or not. I'm not good with those. I've found those guys in Costa Rica, and they're a lot of fun. So anyway, but so if people want to reach out to you about the possibilities of sausages, because we do have people in Canada that listen to us, or just want to like bounce ideas off of you with the Pseudoxenodon, learn more, or talk to you about the possibility of imports, because I do know that you will broker between Europe to Canada, then Canada to US. How do people go about doing that? Do you want people to do that? what does that process look like?
The best way to contact me is through my normal Facebook page. It's Ashley DeZan. Nobody, please don't get offended if I don't answer you, just because I'm so busy running two businesses. I forget very easily. It's like no harm, I swear. But basically my main profile, I will answer my business profiles, which is Northern Lights, Reptile Imports, and Reptibites, but it'll just take a little longer.
There we go.
Yeah.
All righty. Well, those of you who want to reach out to me, as always, Zach Loafman on Facebook, Instagram, it's Dr. Crawdad, and then graduate students, undergrads that want to come here, you can reach out to me through social media. That is totally fine. But if you want it to be more formal, Z Loafman, ZLOUGHMAN at westliberty.edu is the best way to get a hold of me. And then Clint, as always, how can people get a hold of you?
You can message me directly on Facebook, Clint Bartley. You can also message the Metazotics Facebook page. You can find us at Metazotics LLC on Instagram. Our email address is metazotics@gmail.com. And of course, if you ever want to take a look at anything we have, metazotics.com is going to be the easiest place to find that.
All righty. So as always, whatever time of day, night, evening, morning it is, hope you have a good one. Later.